What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Many of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, which is my effort to find the most interesting people in the world and sit with them for hours while I ask questions in an effort to learn. So it would mean the world to me if you would subscribe to the show on your favorite audio platform, watch episodes on YouTube, and tell your friends and family about the podcast. My goal is to help millions learn from the world's most interesting people. So let's get into today's episode. Today's episode is with Nate Fisher. Nate is the founder of New Founding and also the founder of American Reformer. In this conversation, we talk about it all: economics, geopolitics, and where the world is headed. We talk about the arrow of direction being disintegration and anarchy, how the attempted deplatforming of Russia from the global stage has impacted so much of our world, why he owns an ammunition company, a breakdown of globalization and how that could occur, what the future of warfare looks like, how turmoil and the end of the current regime is possible, why optimist version of the future will win, and how somebody like President Trump's erratic, unpredictable behavior could be a good fit for the future that we're headed into, and then where exactly you can allocate capital today and where Nate is allocating his capital, including betting on people, not numbers, and how things like trust-minimized infrastructure or trust-maximizing groups of people is where he thinks lots of value is going to accrue. And then we touch on value alignment and how things like immigration are affecting both positively and negatively the value alignment that happens in different societies. This is a wide-ranging conversation. Nate is a fascinating person. He's thought deeply about many of the topics that we discussed today. So I'm excited for you all to hear this. Here is my conversation with Nate Fisher.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
This episode is brought to you by Freck. Historically, the wealthy had a hidden secret in investing. They would spend a lot of money and use very big teams to conduct tax loss harvesting. Tax loss harvesting is the timely selling of securities at a loss to offset the amount of capital gains tax owed from selling the profitable assets later. But now Freck is bringing this incredible advantage to any investor. They'll literally lower your tax bill, regardless of how much money you have. They use state-of-the-art technology through a product called Direct Indexing to allow investors to invest in the S&P 500 while getting all the benefits of tax loss harvesting without the big bill. If you want to learn more, go check them out at freck.com. That's F-R-E-C.com. I'm a big fan of the product, and I even became an investor in the business. Freck.com. Go check them out today. Today's episode is brought to you by Espresso, the maker of the world's thinnest portable display. Now listen up, if you're like me, you feel like you are at a command center when you sit down at your desk. I got a gazillion tabs open and different windows for different activities. There's my web browser, my text messages, I have Slack open, and I got a notes app. I normally work on a desktop and it can be very, very productive. But everything falls apart the second I leave my desk. If I'm traveling, if I go to a coffee shop to do some work, or just want to work from the kitchen table, my laptop doesn't have enough screen space. I lose my command center and my productivity falls off a cliff. It's a major problem. But this is where Espresso comes in. They have a portable screen that is so beautiful that you think Steve Jobs came back from the dead to create it. The thing is incredibly light, it comes with a nice stand, and the user interface is so easy that I figured it out. How to do it in less than 3 minutes. If you listen to this podcast, you know that's not an easy feat. So the Espresso team and I, we became friends. I got to know them because I really like the product. And those screens, they now want to offer them to any fan of the podcast. So we struck a little deal. Here's how it works. Anyone who listens to this podcast can go to us.espres.so. Or, that's too confusing, just go click the link in the description. If you go to Espresso's website, they've got a brand new offer there sitting for you. You get a little discount and you'll get a beautiful screen. Trust me, I use mine every day. You'll love the Espresso screen and I think it'll make you more productive. Go check them out today by clicking on the link in the description. All right, guys, bang, bang. I've got Nate here. I thought a great place to start this conversation is let's talk about the vision for the future, and we can work ourselves backwards to today and what we have to do to kind of set ourselves on that path. But right now, it seems like there are two different cohorts of people. There are the optimists And there are the doomers. The optimists believe that the future is brighter. The optimists believe that technology, capitalism, democracy, etc., not only are defaults needed, but also can drastically accelerate us into that brighter future. The doomers basically believe almost the complete opposite. Hey, we should stop all progress. Everything ahead is really bad. It's a dire situation. And any progress we try to make will only make it worse, not better. And so when you look at it, I know you fall into the optimist camp, but what exactly does that look specifically? Right? Are there certain milestones or finish lines that you look at that kind of say, hey, we will know we have achieved this vision when A, B, and C occur?
So high level, yes, I fall into the optimist camp, although I'd say I take a different approach than a lot of people in the optimist camp, and that I see turmoil and potential end of the current regime in many ways. A lot of change. I just believe that we're better positioned to come through this. And I speak as someone who's sort of known to be on the political right and all that. I believe we're better positioned to come through this than many people tend to assume. So what would be success? To me, success is a world where we're going to see a lot of values baked into the algorithms that govern everyday life. In many ways, that's the government of the digital age. And success for me means that the values that can govern my life and can govern life of people who are close to me are those that reflect fundamentally our values and sort of our way of life. So the scale of that, I think, is an open question. This is one reason I think the degree of my optimism is uncertain. But can we, at some level, and whether that means there's a disintegration from sort of large scale government to smaller scale, or if necessary, large scale, can we operate in an environment where we can live our way of life and we can thrive in our way of life?
When you say government, normally, I think people in the tech industry say there's a separation of church and state. There is the politics, the government, et cetera. And then there are the technologists, the venture capitalist, and kind of the entrepreneurial ecosystem. It feels like those two things used to be very polar opposites, and they did not have a lot of integration. There was not kind of a graying of that line. In the last couple of months, if not last, 2 to 3 years, it feels like those things are becoming much, much more kind of related, integrated, in some cases working together, in other cases becoming more abrasive with each other. And so how do you look at the relationship between government and politics with kind of entrepreneurial endeavors, whether it's on the capital allocation side or from a kind of an entrepreneurial building side?
So I would say going back many years, and I think back to the mid-late teens of the last decade, I look at sort of intuitively sense that these digital platforms are de facto governments. They're layers of government. They're not just, when you have a monopoly platform that has significant power over aspects of your life, whether it's on the financial side, whether it's a search algorithm that in many ways determines what people believe and what they consume, that in many ways is a de facto government. And certainly you could look at it, you could say that has as much power as a government does in many ways. And as we've seen the emergence of, as we see the digital age emerge, I think you can very easily say there's just an additional layer of government, right? You sort of intuitively recognize there's a local government. Everyone calls it a government. There's a state government. People call it a government. There's a federal government. And I would say there's a digital layer of government. And the nature of digital, I mean, you have sort of vying powers between those different layers. Typically, they're fairly, at the federal level, it's fairly integrated. At the local level, you can sort of switch between municipalities, for instance. I think right now you have a world where there's a lot of vying at the digital layer, but there's no question that those who control these powerful monopoly digital platforms are, in a sense, sort of lords or magistrates of digital domains. And I think you look at Elon's acquisition of Twitter, and that was a point where it's sort of very clear to everyone, like, this is not a typical sort of financial buyer buying an asset, a company. It wasn't some guy. It wasn't like the acquisition of Revlon back in the 80s when the corporate raiders were taking it over. And it was clearly just sort of a financial move. We're going to bust this up. We're going to sell assets. No, it was much more akin to like one feudal lord capturing a castle. And now he controls something that everyone recognizes has significant political power. You could even think of it as during the 30 Years' War era, it sort of shifts from Protestant to Catholic or Catholic to whatever. And so I think that there's a very clear sense, I think, that people intuitively recognize the political nature of this rule. And I think it's useful in a world where the very concept of governance is a little bit in flux to just have a continuum between business and government rather than see it as a bright line.
What's interesting is the government, in the traditional sense, they have a monopoly on violence. They can remove property at times. They can put you in jail and remove your freedom. They can use economic means to sanction or fine you. And it all really is rooted in that monopoly on violence. In the digital realm, although it is not physical violence, there are a lot of corollaries to your point. You know, they can deplatform you. They can put you in Twitter jail with either less reach, or maybe you can't post. YouTube, notoriously, if you get a strike on the platform, you then can't post for a number of days. And so it does feel like there is some mirroring of what the actual governments are doing with what these kind of digital governments have come up with. But what I wonder is, can they stay separate? Like, is the end conclusion just that the state tries to really nationalize many of these platforms in some form or fashion? If you listen to some people, they'd say, hey, they already have done this with soft power, right? They're already censoring. They're already kind of influencing what's happening on these platforms. I think the great fear is, could it actually become hard power to a degree? And the state says, look, these are information platforms, and it's a national security concern if people say certain things or they do certain things on these platforms. And therefore, we want to have even more kind of governance over them than what they have today.
You saw that in China. So it's very clear that, and I think there's going to be a very strong parallel between what many people here in the U.S. want and what happened in China. I mean, to the point that you hear Sam Altman talking about cooperating with the Chinese on AI regulations. So no question they're going to try that. At the same time, I think that in many ways, and I sort of buy into the thesis, Balaji's talked about this, and people have talked about this, I buy into the thesis that many of the trends are actually in the direction of disintegration and anarchy rather than the direction of centralized state power. I think that the U.S.'s state capacity is limited in terms of its ability to execute what you describe, even if it wanted to. Whereas I think you're seeing, I think Elon's acquisition of Twitter is a perfect example of this. You saw what was to some extent a sort of integrated regime controlling the major tech platforms, and they lost one of the most important strategic assets there, and that significantly impedes their ability to regulate. So I think what you're going to see, if anything, and you talk about a monopoly of violence, I'll push back on one point there, which is, I think I like to emphasize this as certainly as someone who is personally in the firearms industry, but also emphasizing that they have a monopoly on certain types of violence. The U.S. has always recognized that there's different levels of violence, right? You as a private citizen have the right to defend your home and to use violence in certain circumstances that fall outside of the state's bounds. So there's, even there, there's limits that recognize a distribution of that, power. But I think that in a world where you have potentially a disintegration, probably a drop in societal trust, a disintegration of many of these sort of large scale government monopolies, certainly, I think, let's say, just less federal ability to control certain things. What you'll likely see is a relative increase. I mean, in a world where there's not that universal control, and they tried it with Russia, right? They tried to sort of deplatform Russia following the Russia-Ukraine war in a way that I think resembled a sort of a global extension of that power. And to a large extent, I think they failed to achieve that. They certainly failed to achieve sort of the significant checking of Russia that they had in mind. What you'll see is you'll have to see more and more punishments resemble the ostracism that is what happens on tech platforms. So yes, violence is conventionally associated with the state, but one of the oldest penalties in time is ostracism, the Greek states. One of the things they would do is they would ostracize you. They would force you to leave, and you're not welcome in the society. And that's effectively what digital platforms can do. They have very limited ability to enforce anything with violence. They may have very limited ability to enforce things in the courts, right? In a global system, you have a lot of people, they're operating pseudonymously. They could be judgment proof. It could be very difficult to enforce that. What can they do? They can absolutely ostracize you from their society. And I think what you'll see is, I think you'll probably see a growing significance of that sort of ostracism as a penalty, potentially extending even to local societies, to the point that local businesses, right? Costco as a club is able to maintain a certain level of quality inside the store experience that in a lower trust society is harder to achieve in a CVS that has to put a lot of things behind plastic because of fear of theft. You'll see that sort of privatization of spaces to the point that many of the things that we might take for granted as part of a society are something that you need to be a member in good standing of the society to benefit from. And that could be that network could actually be a digital first network in many cases. Now, you could imagine that de facto applies to entire towns, de facto applies to entire regions, but people can sort of escape the consequences by leaving. But to be a part of something, you need to remain a member in good standing. So there's a world where you see that digital model actually coming back into the physical world.
And you mentioned earlier this arrow of direction of disintegration and anarchy. Describe that a little bit more in terms of what does that look like?
So I think, this is not a strong thesis of mine, but I would say the way Balaji talked about it is sort of, in a sense, both the right and the left are actually pushing for de facto anarchy. The right is obviously pushing for gun rights. They're pushing for loss of trust in many of the federal institutions. They've been pushing for smaller government for a long time. Most of our emphasis is on challenging institutions rather than on sort of consolidating. I mean, as an out of power sort of dissident movement, very little ability to sort of consolidate and execute power. But the left also is pushing toward anarchic ends, abolish the police, reducing enforcement of crime. And yes, they sort of have isolated cases where they'll try to really drop the hammer of government on certain things, but they lack the capacity to scale that. So I think you can look at the gun control debate as an interesting example. And actually, I've owned an ammo company for a number of years, and it was interesting. It used to be, and this is sort of a grim way of putting it, well, it used to be that there were sort of two things that were resulting in a pop of ammo prices: election of Democrats, school shooting. And school shooting, obviously, the implication was that's going to result in sort of a public push for gun control. What's really been interesting is the last couple of years, you did not see that. There was no pop after the 2022 election. There was no pop after the Uvalde school shooting. And I think what we realized sort of collectively is there's no chance that gun control gets passed. The trend has just been stronger and stronger to solidify this right to own weapons. And essentially, in a world where sort of the heat turns up, the temperature turns up, that is one of the things that people are just not going to compromise on over their dead body type of mindset. And I think that's indicative of a sense that government is growing weaker in terms of the ability to achieve any sort of consensus to take power away from distributed power and concentrate it with the government. Going back to that question of monopoly of violence, the government sort of losing its ability to have that monopoly on violence even where it wants it. So that would be one manifestation. I think another manifestation is the loss of their ability to control the tech platforms. So it's their loss of ability to control Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin there's clearly people, many, many people who would be seen as sort of influential people in the regime who wanted to seriously check it. Elizabeth Warren, people like that, Gensler, not succeeding in doing so. And I think I think almost certainly lacking the political ability to achieve that. So that's sort of a secular trend. Ways I've framed some of that too is you're seeing this breakdown of globalization broadly. or a breakdown. It's a growing sense of global disruption. I mean, what do you see in the Red Sea? You see asymmetric warfare where I think a drone that might cost a few thousand dollars can take out a ship, or can it would cost millions of dollars to stop that single drone. And so you're seeing the situation where across the board, you're seeing a breakdown of the ability to enforce some sort of rules-based global order, which is not necessarily what we think of anarchy when we think of it at the local level, but without question, it's sort of a growing global anarchy. Again, the sanctions regime, the U.S. is no longer the sort of global hegemon. It no longer has the ability to stop Russia, even using a lot of tools that it thought it had. So you're certainly seeing at the global level a growing disintegration of that power and a tendency toward distributed power.
How much of that breakdown is political, and lack, frankly, of the ability for us to use diplomacy versus it is a technical advancement for, quote unquote, the enemy? And I'll give you two examples. One would be, hey, we are projecting a weak position given the current administration. Our diplomats seem to be much more interested in preconceived notions about how we need to react or posture ourselves to certain nations. You can see that Russia-Ukraine proposed peace plans, and then the U.S. kind of stepping in and rejecting them in some cases. And so the diplomacy seems to be in a weird position. At the same time, you're talking about, you know, a $10,000 missile. I think the Houthis recently just shot down a U.S. drone that cost a couple million dollars. You're talking about, you know, a couple $1,000 drone being able to create havoc and really shut down some of these situations. And so is it geopolitical and diplomacy? Is it technology? Or is it maybe like they're both the same thing, just coming at it from different angles?
I mean, I think they inevitably converge in the sense that diplomacy ultimately, diplomacy is always done in the shadow of conflict, right? It's either there's true shared interests and there's real sort of altruistic alignment, but I think for most of these cases, it's people have very different interests, and as technology changes what a kinetic conflict would look like, changes the calculus of a kinetic conflict, that's obviously going to lead to a very different diplomatic stance to people who are representing the different parties. And especially if one side recognizes that, and I think you may well see this, I don't know what's going on in the minds of people in the U.S., but it wouldn't surprise me if there's a lot of parties that they both have a different set of values. They don't ultimately assume some of the assumptions of sort of end state liberalism, liberal ideals, economic utilitarianism that might be assumed by, I think, many in the sort of beltway group. But they also recognize that they have the ability to, they recognize weakness on the U.S.'s part. They recognize that their drone can potentially impose an asymmetric cost. They recognize that the U.S. has failed to, despite its support for Ukraine, it's failed to check Russia, which is much poorer country by every measure, and when you see that kind of thing happening, it certainly will embolden people who are willing to diplomatically challenge the U.S. So I think those two inevitably go together, and I think ultimately I would say I'm sympathetic probably to the technological. I wouldn't go as far as technological determinism, but the sort of sovereign individual thesis that the digital age is fundamentally changing many aspects of the fundamental drivers that sort of shape the very sort of nature of sovereignty at the global level.
As we get disintegration, anarchy, breakdown of globalization, it seems like maybe the trade-off is higher degrees of uncertainty and chaos. And so if you fall back on an assumption of you can't be rational with irrational people, specifically, we've seen this in conflicts on the ground where we have insurgents fighting kind of a more mechanized, you know, military in Iraq or Afghanistan. It's been very difficult for the mechanized army to be able to win and win consistently over years. It feels like maybe the leadership historically in the United States, we've prided ourselves on being A, presidential, and B, very predictable. Rational, being somewhat of an intellect and kind of control of emotions that would lend itself to that diplomatic approach. When Trump got into office, I think one of the critiques of him was he's erratic. He is irrational. He is unpredictable. And people saw that as a negative. Is there an argument that maybe that approach is actually what is needed for a world where uncertainty, chaos, and kind of this breakdown of globalization is actually like a better potential outcome for people?
I mean, I think there's a lot of, and I'm not an expert in this space at all, but my impression is there's a lot of game theory support for the idea that someone who's less predictable can be much more effective at any number of even very conventional. And I would say this potentially applies to even conventional diplomatic calculus with rational actors, not just the irrational ones. He's unpredictable. He's also potentially unconstrained by a lot of norms. And if we're sort of voluntarily constrained by a whole bunch of norms, that makes us predictable in a way that makes it easier to game interactions with us, even by a rational actor or someone who may value something differently. They may be willing to take a risk that we're unwilling to take. So I definitely think that unwillingness, that sort of lack of constraint can be an asset. Now I'll jump into and sort of take this in a slightly different direction. I mean, we're talking globally. I would say I spend most of my time thinking about the nature of sort of interactions domestically, but in some sense apply that same lens. I mean, when you're talking about a trend toward anarchy, that same lens you use for global relations applies to thinking to competition between factions within the U.S., competition between different layers of government. And I think there's no question we're seeing an escalation of volatility. And this is the frame I've looked at, again, going back to actually the question of how I can remain optimistic, where a lot of people would look at the domestic political situation and they would say, the left is ratcheting up its power. For instance, they arrest Trump. There was the Trump arrest. There's the rulings in New York. There's various things that are just sort of all seem like pretty straightforward exercises of power. They're showing that they're willing to venture outside of norms in a way that many people would say just shows that it's another win for them, And it's another example of consolidation of power. But anytime you see a departure from norms, you can think of sort of a stock market or a markets analogy where that's like a big jump. That's a big move in a particular day. And what does that mean? It means higher volatility. Yes, it means a move in a particular direction. But even more than that, I think many people will look at that and they'll say that's an escalation of volatility, which means an increase in the range of potential outcomes, a wide increase. And you look at the last couple of years, and I think you could say there's a wide increase in the range of potential outcomes politically, even within the U.S., as well as geopolitically outside. The same dynamic is true. And it's impossible to predict. Volatility by nature means it can go both directions. And so I think we're in a situation where we've seen larger and larger departures, which is the sign of sort of a regime that's losing its grip on power in many ways. Like if they really have solid power, yes, in theory, they can sort of ratchet things up as a sort of final consolidation of power. But in most cases, they're not going to want to turn up the temperature. They're not going to want to increase that volatility if they have a firm grip on power. They would rather sort of slowly suffocate their opponents. So I think we're seeing the manifestations of sometimes a move from soft power to hard power as the regime loses a level of that grip, an increase in volatility in terms of the range of potential outcomes. And you're going to see in a world with a wide range of potential outcomes, absolutely the people who are willing to do something outside the box and take a bold stand, going back to your point about Trump, absolutely those are the players who tend to move the needle. And it's unclear which side. I mean, you could see a Bolshevik who does something like that, right? And so there's potentially very bad outcomes. You think of the sort of years of the Russian Revolution or months even of the Russian Revolution where the balance sort of where sort of the fate of the country hung in the balance, and that's a very high volatility situation. So it's not clear which direction it can go, but I think people like that will have an outsized disproportionate impact on the future in a world where we see this growing volatility.
You've previously written a piece called titled Finance Means Betting on People, Not Numbers. And you already mentioned that you own this ammunition company, which is something that most people either one would sit out because like, oh, it's ammunition is kind of, you know, in that vice category. And so something I don't want to do. Or two, they would have to be an original critical thinker that gets them to a thesis on why ammunition will become more valuable. And it's not exactly clear that many people, one, can do the independent critical thinking, and then two, come to the conclusion of how to play certain, you know, societal or political movements and developments by allocating capital. So how do you think about your investment thesis, and maybe what is that process to come to some of these conclusions or find some of these ideas of where to allocate capital?
So I'll start with the ammo company, which is a little bit actually outside of the core of what I do, but it ties directly into my last point. I bought the ammo company in May of 2020. I had no experience in the industry, very, very little experience in the industry. I worked with some people who had a lot more experience in it, but the opportunity came up. And to me, I looked at it as a left tail risk hedge. In extreme scenarios, obviously May of 2020 was a situation where we sort of recognized there was a lot of uncertainty, a lot wide range of potential outcomes. And there's certain scenarios where it just seemed like an ammo company was it would be an outsized return in otherwise very bad situations, almost like an insurance policy. But to the point of a type of insurance that you can't necessarily financially plan for, as financial markets might get caught up in lots of uncertainty. That sort of thing didn't play out, but that doesn't necessarily. I mean, a lot of times you buy something that comes off as insurance. I mean, it's played out. It hasn't been an extremely profitable investment. As I said, ammo was sort of cyclical based on political events. But more broadly, how do I think about investing? I think about investing, to go to your point about the betting on people rather than numbers. Fundamentally, entrepreneurial investing, the sort of investing that's going to produce outsized returns. I think there's trading, there's speculating, right? That can be betting on market movement, sentiment, things like that. But ultimately, like, the entrepreneurial allocation of capital comes down to, more than anything, a willingness to take a bet on a person that goes beyond something that you could perfectly justify on a spreadsheet. So what you've seen is you've seen this trend toward the sort of managerial, bureaucratic administration of finance. You can think of this as the trend from let's call it the hedge fund manager, the multi-strategy hedge fund manager, or just individual investor who really can sort of make whatever trade or bet he sees opportunistically as attractive, to BlackRock. BlackRock, in many cases, doesn't even have any skin in the game in their investment, right? They take a certain number of basis points. They essentially have a set of bureaucrats who administer a strategy that in many ways is in turn set by sort of other bureaucrats and analysts, right? It's an index fund. The index itself is sort of intentionally stripping human judgment out of the concept and replacing it with some sort of formula. So you've seen this move toward I would call it just managerial finance. It's a finance where everything is proven with models. Everything is proven on a spreadsheet. And any sort of human judgment is removed from that. I would say it actually reflects a fairly pessimistic view of the person, in a sense. And the opposite of that, I think, is the sort of truly entrepreneurial venture capital bet, where you, and it could be venture capital in classic venture sense, it could be in a very basic sense, right? You see a young guy in your community who's a hustler, and he needs that he needs that sort of initial capital to begin flipping houses or whatever. And you recognize that this guy has something, not a degree, it's not that he has the MBA or whatever. It's not that he checks certain boxes. You just see that, like, this guy has the traits to know how to make money, and you take that bet on him. In both cases, those are bets on a person where, if you're right, you're potentially creating enormous value. You're both getting someone started in a career that can be quite rewarding. And if, depending on the structure, you can be greatly financially rewarded for it, far in excess of what you would get through the sort of formulaic managerial allocation of capital. I think we've seen that systematically stripped out of our system as more and more investment goes to passive. I think we saw probably a great bubble where the move to passive in some sense becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy as more and more capital flows in, and really as the premium for what's recognized as a sort of highly desirable financial asset elevates prices. My bet is that's going to reverse. My bet is that a lot of that is driven by sort of the trend toward passive as much as it's driven by underlying fundamentals. And we're going to see a return of more and more return for those who can continue to make outsized bets on people that are rewarding. And that, again, I use two examples, but there's a whole continuum there. I mean, there's plenty of hedge funds that have been extremely successful buying post-IPO companies, even mid-stage companies, where they'll really get to know the CEO and they'll really recognize that this is the kind of person who's going to just produce outsized returns. I mean, a lot of the best ones they both underwrite a CEO and they look at someone who actually owns significant equity in the company, and they look for that skin in the game. And it's kind of like that combination. Does this person have this alignment, and does he have the ability to and the traits to just earn, drive an outsized return here? And again, that's not my personal focus, but you see it done well. My personal focus, to some extent, at the abstract is how do we look for the bastions of sort of trust that remain, the dynamics that continue to be able to produce those kind of outsized bets on people in a world where, in a sense, people have become marginalized in the allocation of capital.
Explain that one more in terms of give me maybe an example or where do you actually see that happening?
So venture capital is just one of the straightforward ones, I think, and where we have a venture firm. So New Founding last fall launched a venture firm. Our firm is sort of specifically focused on companies in some way associated with the right. And I use the right broadly. It talks about a lot of the themes that I'm actually talking about here. But very practically, we see a lot of founders. We see a lot of founders who in many ways are also, by nature of sort of their values, their politics or whatever, they're not playing the very conventional venture game. And I think you could actually say aspects of the conventional venture game have become managerial in nature, right? The way to get venture capital in certain circles resembles the path to get an MBA. I mean, you do the right sort of prerequisite extracurriculars, you adopt the right aesthetic, adopt the right sort of trendy, jump into the category that's trending in the right way. And it's very formulaic, and that will get people certain types of venture capital. I would say that's not necessarily very entrepreneurial as much as people may pretend it is. But we're dealing with people who are outside of that. We're dealing with people where in some sense there's sort of a dissident aspect of their business, whether it's sort of a category that's intrinsically just not as, you mentioned Animo in this category. I mean, Animo's not really a venture backable business, but we did an investment in a company called Arminet, which is a ad network focused on the firearms space. And firearms space is a space that's been blacklisted by advertisers by and large. We looked at the team. We were very, very impressed with the people. We're very impressed with both their capability, their grit, what they've done so far. They're obviously operating in a sector where most venture capitalists are not going to be wanting to deal with that. They're specifically providing services to a lot of censored publishers, gun blogs or whatever, who aren't going to be able to get conventional display ads from Google and some of the better networks. But ultimately, what does that bet come down to? Ultimately, that bet comes down to, yes, we can sort of underwrite the economics of the space. We can underwrite the how big, what's the total available market, total addressable market, all that. Ultimately, it's a bet on the person. Like, do we look at these people and believe these are people who can execute? And that is the essence of, in many ways, every successful venture bet. So that would be one illustration of that. And then I think the opposite end of the spectrum, to some extent, is not something I'm doing in what would be seen as an investment format, but sort of a continual problem I look at. And one of the sort of central things that we're looking at is how do we facilitate more connection within aligned communities. So as you look at things like how do you choose a lawyer? Like, that's not an investment decision, but it is a risky decision you're taking. You're taking a bet on a person. You can obviously go to sort of the most conventional option where you just go to the white shoe firm, you pay up for it, you go for someone who's fully credentialized, and you theoretically know what you're getting, but you're paying for it. If you go for someone who's lower cost than that, you're kind of taking a bet on the person. Am I going to get someone who's going to get me as good of an outcome? I analogize that to an investment decision. I think that there's many, many times as many decisions that resemble that that are made. Again, those have also become very bureaucratized segments, just as hiring has become very bureaucratized through HR. You've seen a consolidation of law firms. You've seen something where sort of school rank matters more and more. And again, I think that people are losing trust in that system. I think you're seeing a breakdown where increasingly, I mean, you saw the controversy with Harvard at the beginning of this year, and it's sort of that kind of thing will reverberate. The value of a Harvard degree will drop as a credential. The value of being at a big law firm, someone goes to a big law firm, you don't know that you're getting the best quality lawyering anymore. I mean, I've sort of seen this up close when I was spending a few summers there back in law school, but even then, there's a risk associated with it. And I think you're going to see a sort of steady drop in societal trust and trust in these elite institutions in society. And you're going to see more and more of a search for alternatives, many of which are going to come through sort of alternative trust-based networks. An example I give is like a church community. Ask for a recommendation from someone else who goes to your church. That's a different way of getting, it's a true alternative to these institutional credentials. It's the same way, going back to the investing, that you're likely to find the sort of person that you're going to bet on flipping houses, right? You're usually depending on existing social networks. And to go back to sort of the real estate example, there were incredibly dynamic communities. You think of like the Jewish community in Brooklyn in the 50s, for instance, lots of immigrants, many cases had not yet cracked elite schools. Enormous opportunities that were through those sort of informal networks where someone will take you impress someone in property management, someone takes a bet on you, and that's what gets someone started on a multi-million dollar real estate career. And there's just story after story after story of people who got that start, their start that way. And I think in a world where we see a reverse of the institutionalization that's taken place over the last decades, you're going to see more and more of those risk-based bets returning to high trust aligned communities. So the question then is, how do we find the communities that maintain those dynamics? Far fewer today than I think were true then. And how do we start to build the infrastructure to facilitate high value interactions, whether they be that hiring of a lawyer or the allocation of capital?
What's interesting about this description or kind of framework is that many of the best venture investments come through exactly what you're talking about, in terms of there's a social network, that social network is making recommendations, people continue to build social capital, that capital then eventually gets cashed in for an investment in a company, they take that capital, they're able to allocate it correctly, build a product for a problem, and then they go and they end up having success and kind of everyone wins, and the cycle restarts, right? That capital gets recycled throughout a community, et cetera. But also there's this element of, there's a saying in the military, aim small, miss small. And so when I hear, using spreadsheets to make investment decisions, the reason why you have to put it on a spreadsheet is because you're trying to figure out, like, are there basis points difference between, yep, like the cost versus the return? And so aim small, miss small. Like, you can potentially lose money on a small scale because you are trying to eke out 100 or 200 basis points in your spreadsheet, you know, type work. What you're really talking about is kind of aim big, miss big. And it reminds me of very early on when I got to Silicon Valley, somebody told me, you will be rewarded here for either creating rocket ships or craters in the earth. And what people outside of this don't understand is you get just as much credit for the crater in the earth as you do for the rocket ship in some cases, because people want to reward ambition and going big. And if you go big over and over and over again, and you're eventually right one time, it has such a ridiculous amount of value creation and capture that it pays for all the times that you were wrong. And so it does feel like you see the same framework being applied across investing, across finding things within your network, across how you allocate your time personally. And it's this thing that just repeats throughout your life.
I mean, I think that's absolutely, and just the perfect example of that is Adam Neumann, who rocket ship, giant crater of WeWork. Within a year, year and a half, I think he gets another $300 million for a new project. And ultimately, you recognize in a world where, and it goes to that point about, again, like going back to the political leader thing too, in a world of high volatility, the only sort of person who can produce those outsized outcomes, who can produce that $100 billion plus outcome, is someone who can take those giant swings. And a lot of people laugh at that. They think that's a sort of just exemplifies the bad judgment of venture capitalists. I'm not so sure. I think there's very smart reasons to believe you bet on someone who can build something, right? The economics may not have been great for WeWork, But it's a concept that had value. It was not a it was not something that was a total sort of pure financial bubble or anything like that. It was something that people continued to use. So I think that yes, there's an outsized return for aiming for something like that and going big. I do think that the right models of this have built-in optionality as well in many ways. I mean, if there's built-in optionality, and that is inherent in the venture model, right? I mean, you give someone $20 million, let's say, yes, that's a lot of money. Yes, they might lose it. But the upside in that scenario is you can keep re-upping in future rounds. And the way venture inherently stages means that even the losses are a lot smaller than you might see in if you tried to take similar swings with a private equity model, conventional private equity model, or certainly with a government model. I mean, look, if the government takes a swing with solar or something, and there's hundreds of billions of dollars flushed down the drain, so, or Ukraine or whatever. So I think you see situations where, yes, they're seen as that sort of smoking crater, but it's actually, given the built-in optionality and really any model that has a lot of skin in the game like that, it actually ends up producing, by and large, it produces expectation of positive returns. I think ultimately bets on resourceful people do produce good outcomes.
What's interesting also is the same things that are true 20, 30, 40 years ago in terms of these best companies, like obviously the famous book, The Outsiders, you know, essentially, can you, one, be a good capital allocator? Two, can you have a decentralized type organization and push decision-making down to great people who are closest to the problem and allow them to go make those decisions? Like, if you do that, throughout history, you have been able to build great technology and great companies. And if you look today, maybe we use Tesla and Amazon as an example. Tesla is really like 10 different startups inside of one big company. Amazon, very similar type of thing, where AWS and Amazon's actual service or their warehouse operations, yes, they're all interconnected and they maybe are relying on each other, but they're very different types of businesses. And so what I wonder is, and Elon's talked about it from a manufacturing standpoint of like the complexity in assembling a car means that there is a high degree of difficulty for someone to compete with him. But actually the complexity of Amazon, even though it is not necessarily in the manufacturing business, has a lot of similarities. And so when I see a rise in deep tech and kind of these hard problems, I also see it's a rise in difficult solutions to build. And so it feels like, you know, as we leave kind of a zero interest rate environment, we head to, you know, what really is kind of normal interest rate environment. It feels like everyone is kind of put back on their armor and been like, hey, this shit's supposed to be hard, right? I need to go find hard problems. I need to create solutions that are hard to create because that provides a moat. And then capital allocators now also seem to be looking for very different types of opportunities than maybe they were before. And so I don't think there's like a secret council. It's not like you and, you know, 500 people all got together and said, you know what, we're going to all change our investment thesis. Oh, we're going to change the way that we view the world. It almost feels like now as the pendulum swings back in favor of doing the hard things, there's a group of people who kind of almost felt left behind in the zero interest rate environment. And they were like, I don't get why people are allocating capital to some of these other ideas. So maybe talk a little bit as to like how you were allocating capital pre-pandemic, during the pandemic, and then like now, and what are the similarities and maybe what are the differences as you've won, you know, both become more thoughtful about certain things in the world, but also the economic environment has changed.
Well, so, I mean, at the very basic level, my first business was buying distressed apartment buildings in 2000, starting in 2011. We bought a bunch of apartment buildings across Florida and Texas. And in many ways it was a distressed play buying at a fraction of replacement cost. I mean, we were buying things. There were apartments we bought for $10,000 a unit. They had a lot more activity at night than during the day, and it was sort of an interesting. It was a classic distressed opportunity. Our bet was as people move in, there's going to be a convergence toward replacement costs. You could think of that as sort of a classic value play, kind of a bet on these red states, on Florida and Texas demographic trends. That played out by 2015. In many ways, they were sort of that thesis had played out. We continued to hold them. And the Fed continued to print money, and it was kind of ended up probably making twice as much as we could possibly have underwritten for very little more work associated with that. And that was the epitome of sort of pre-pandemic investing. And really, I think you saw zero interest rates obviously continue after that was low interest rate environment and just massive asset inflation. And it's kind of like It's a very easy way to make a lot of money. How do you make a lot of money? You own levered assets. You go long levered assets. Leverage obviously includes debt, but the private equity model itself has inherent built-in leverage for the general partner. And that was a system that rewarded asset owners, period. It's a lot easier in many ways than actually going and building things, but kind of intuitively stepped away from the day-to-day because it wasn't satisfying. Like it wasn't, starting in 2015, I and the co-founder of that both stepped out of the day-to-day operations of the business because it wasn't satisfying, right? It's not, yes, it's a good way to make money, but it didn't feel like that wasn't what we wanted to spend the next 20 years on building. We wanted the harder problems. The market did not reward the harder problems the same way. In many ways, the market, had we just spent the next 5 years in real estate, definitely would have made more money if we just continued to do more real estate deals. Instead, we exited. We sold almost everything in 2019, recognizing the market seemed quite high. And I think sort of anticipated some of the pivot that you're seeing a lot more over the next couple of years into what seemed like serious problems. During the pandemic, I think it was just a sort of extreme example of zero interest rate environment, right? You saw massive bubbles in certain spaces. And then the last year and a half, the last 2 years, you've seen this. Is it a return to? Is it sort of people have refocused on hard problems? Is it more that they're no longer drowned out by the sort of bubbly stuff? I'm not certain. It's unclear. I mean, I think crypto is an interesting example where crypto included people who are focusing on some real problems, but also included enormous amounts of speculative money. In many ways, probably the sort of rise of AI just flushed. I mean, all the sort of speculative trend chasers just moved over to AI, and you saw a lot of people continue to be working on very hard problems. So in many cases, I think those people have always been doing what they're doing, and they're just, the other thing is if you're chasing speculative returns, that disproportionately rewards hype. So the people who are the best at the hype, the people who get the most intention are often going to be the ones who are good at the hype rather than good at solving the hard problems. I'm not saying they don't, I mean, someone like Elon, I think is a absolute master at both of those, but you've seen this environment where I think we're returning to something. You're returning to the recognition that there's not easy money based on financial engineering and based on sort of classic zero interest strategies. And in an environment like that, you may as well get down to something that actually matters. You may as well work on something that's going to create real value.
As we see the world kind of head towards, this optimistic techno kind of future, what are some of the things that on the technology side that you are looking for or you think could be quite valuable that maybe other people do not yet put a lot of value on? Like, are there things that you think are under-discussed or areas where you think more capital should be flowing that will help accelerate us even more?
So absolutely. And this is really the essence of, this goes to the essence of what I'm working on. And that's, there's a lot of technology, and I'll use the crypto world as an example. There's a lot of interest in trust minimized technologies, Bitcoin, blockchain being sort of classic examples. You don't need to trust your counterparties here because the nature of the technology is protocols designed to minimize the need for trust. I think that absolutely makes sense. We need trust minimized infrastructure in a world where you don't trust the Federal Reserve as much. You don't trust Google as much. What I think is underappreciated is that nonetheless never provides the greatest opportunity. Going back to the example of the bet on the guy flipping houses, that is a trust-based bet. And that is a trust-based bet that is only going to take place typically in environments where you've developed relationships, trusted relationships over time. Yeah, you maybe know circles of friends who can vouch for the person. You've seen him growing up, whatever. So I think that the real opportunities, the things ultimately trust minimized is more akin to insurance. No one gets rich on insurance. Yes, some people start insurance companies. Most people don't get rich on insurance. A society doesn't get rich on insurance. It's a necessary thing. It's a valuable thing. It's something there's going to be increasing demand for. as you see more chaos, but ultimately it's still to some extent a cost. Whereas trust creating tools, trust creating networks, those can actually create wealth. Those can actually enable the sorts of entrepreneurial bets, whether it be the venture bet on the person or the bet on the guy getting started flipping houses. They can actually unlock tremendous value as the person who you took the bet on is now able to create more value than the risk that was taken on him. I think that is the side that is largely missing. And what you need in many ways as the sort of the institutionalized mediation of trust decays and collapses, as the sort of trust in university credential, they print credentials, but those credentials increasingly mean less. As institutional trust and societal trust decline, I think there's tremendous opportunities around these remaining bastions of trust in these high trust communities, churches being sort of the church communities and similar communities being, I think, sort of easy examples where a lot of the reason trust is declining is alignment declines, right? When we don't share values with people, there becomes a breakdown in trust and it becomes harder to cooperate in certain ways. So communities that have a natural alignment in values, kind of it can be a range of different such values, but within that community, it's an environment that's conducive to maintaining trust, even as societal trust drops. That to me is a tremendous asset that is going to become more and more scarce in society. An example I actually give is in the 17th century, the Quakers were sort of a famously high trust community. And as there was lots of chaos in England more broadly at that time, religious wars, all sorts of things, they were trusted intermediaries. And they became trusted intermediaries, not just for each other. It wasn't just a value they provided to their community, but outsiders would want to do business with them as intermediaries. And you saw sort of a growing value in their ability to provide that trust-based intermediation to society. And Barclays came out of that era, was founded by Quakers in that era. And it's just one good example of how businesses that are able to scale that trust are valuable. So I think that the untapped resource is, you've seen a lot of focus on trust-based or trust-minimized stuff like Bitcoin. You look at almost any society and sort of the credit side is bigger than the money side, right? Credit is credit creation is usually many multiples of money. And we haven't yet seen the crypto analog, that sort of non-institutional or sort of new disruptive alternative to legacy institutionalized credit creation and trust creation. I think we will see that. That's the central thing I'm working on. And I think when we see that, I think that it could be multiple times the size of the crypto space. And I think that in many cases, it's not something that can be created with technology alone. I think you have sort of even sociological reasons, cultural reasons that you haven't seen that, is there's just enormous cultural gaps between, let's say, these things like tight church communities where there's a concentration of this, and Silicon Valley. Those are very different. It's very easy to see how Silicon Valley and technologists who naturally tend to be libertarian, they naturally tend to be individualists. It's easy to see how they're analogous, I would say, to the trappers and traders, the sort of individualist early adopters who came to America. There's not the same connections between the people building that technology, building that digital frontier, and the tight, high trust communities that might be analogous to the sort of Puritans and Quakers who were the next ones to come to this sort of digital, in our case, the sort of new frontier. In our case, it would be the digital frontier. So, who are going to be the people who are going to build the ships, in a sense, and build the infrastructure that those trust-based communities are going to move out of the institutional world into this new ecosystem, and in many ways gain a power of network effect that can exist in a trust-based network that can't exist in a trust-minimized network, and that could really scale. So that's a broad way of saying, I think we're talking about something that's a many trillion dollar opportunity, analogous to sort of what crypto was to legacy money. This may be analogous to sort of legacy. You could say both sort of credit creation on the finance side as well as credential printing on the university side.
if we go and we look at certain regions in Europe right now, there's a lot of debate where the locals say, hey, we have a very specific value alignment. Those values are clear. Those values are agreed upon by the majority of people. And that has created a certain culture, environment, society, and economy. And there's always things to work on. But for majority of people, they're happy with what that environment looks like. Now, with the rise of immigration, that is being, on some hand, changed. Others would say threatened by people with different values, not better or worse necessarily, just different values being integrated into these societies. If you look here in the United States at the southern border and how porous it has become and the influx, I think there was over 3 million people who came to the United States, the most, the single largest increase in the U.S. population in a given year in history. When you look at that, I don't think the debate is as much around values today, but it does seem to be becoming a louder conversation of, are the people who are coming here have the same values? Now, in a country in Europe, it is less of a country of immigration compared to a country like the United States, which is kind of the melting pot of the world. And literally the country was built by tons of people from different countries coming here together. And so how do you look at value alignment and how it changes in certain regions, both in, you know, maybe a pick a country in Europe and then here in the United States, given the rise of immigration globally and how it has become a controversial, highly debated topic?
So I think I'll start with the immigration, which vastly exacerbates the problem. And I think you see very, very sharp conflicts in values in many ways. You're right that I think the U.S. has sort of more of a mechanism for integration than many European countries do. It's arguable you're seeing a breakdown of consensus even outside of immigration, right? Even within the U.S., you're seeing, even within sort of legacy U.S. populations, you're seeing more and more sharp divisions, even though there's sort of much, much more in common there. So the point is, if even that has trouble finding consensus, if you're seeing a fracturing on that basis, how much more does immigration of people with vastly different sets of values exacerbate that? But it could be that in this world, in the world we're in, there is we lack the means. We lack perhaps the technological means that you had when you had sort of the television era and three channels to try to force a consensus at that level of scale. If that's the case, then we need to think about what alignment looks like, what's viable. And again, I would probably gravitate toward a fractal model. I do think that we need to minimize, at the national level, we need to minimize disruption. I certainly think that we need to cut back the border crossings. I think Europe has sort of a burning need to reverse this very, very quickly. But even at the local level, I mean, even where you have different values within a particular city, the natural, It may be futile to look for a sort of consensus across a state, a consensus across a city. It may be that the natural organization of people is sort of fractal, where it is at the level of that particular community. The example, again, I gave of the church, right? And you can imagine there's like different churches with different values. And then there's other communities that aren't part of a church, right? Different religions. There's maybe a different set of schools. And move away from this model where you need global consensus of things. So part of it is, can you change that sort of substrate to trust minimize? That's where the real trust minimized technology value comes in. Can you, where possible, move to something that's trust minimized that doesn't force force alignment of values, doesn't force everyone to agree on something? Second of all, just move certain types of mediation to layers that allow more localism. So if everyone in the U.S. needs to compete to get into Harvard or get into some school that sort of plays the same game as Harvard and has the same standards as Harvard, because that is sort of a universal credential hierarchy, and there's a set of values that are sort of rigidly imposed through that, that requires a consensus, or it's a de facto imposition of values across all of society. Your economic opportunity effectively comes from joining the party and playing the party game, not much different than it does in China. In a world where you have a diversity of institutions, in a world where even more so, maybe more of your economic opportunity is mediated through, to use the opposite example, you're recommended by someone in your church to someone who owns a business who's going to bring someone on to a job that can lead to that same sort of potential economic outcome. You don't depend on that same level of consensus. That happens sort of outward through the local community in a way that lets you primarily work with and sort of invest in those relationships with, invest in gaining the approval of and building trust with people who generally share your values. And there may be very different communities that have very different values, and it's not debilitating. Whereas at Harvard, if it's all one status hierarchy, it becomes a sort of all or nothing battle for what is the value system that's going to be rewarded or punished within that hierarchy. So I think the fractal is one solution. The thing about migration that I think makes this particularly hard is you're bringing people often directly into a community. And like, as much as you can have parallel communities, who your neighbors are do matter. There needs to be a degree of consensus, certainly on things like physical and violent crime and enforcement of those matters. That needs to happen at the local level. So there's no digital solution to, you can't have three parallel polities all mixed with each other in one city where one of them has an anarchic view of physical violent crime, or you end up like South Africa or Brazil, where you kind of need to operate within gated communities and bulletproof cars, which I don't think people find desirable. So there needs to be a degree of agreement at the local level. But I think you'll still see a movement away from a model that demands national consensus on everything.
The United States has historically been kind of the policeman of the world. A lot of people have drawn, allyship with us because they see that we can protect them. We can help to maybe deter potential danger for those countries or certain populations. At the same time, the U.S. has either implicitly or explicitly wanted to outsource their values, whether it's democracy and capitalism or other maybe kind of religious type values and the things that we hold dear here in American society. I wonder, in this world where uncertainty and chaos increases, globalization decreases, and we now have more problems at home. We see, obviously, with Ukraine and Russia, we see with Israel and Gaza, it almost feels like we're trying to continue to uphold our promises, but do it via a proxy war rather than a direct intervention. And then when you look at things like the southern border, you say, oh, wait a second here. We have the same problem as maybe some of our allies in Europe do. We are going to have to use money now becomes a weapon in some cases, much more than bullets, bombs, and soldiers. Doesn't mean that we're not going to use the bullets, bombs, and soldiers if and when necessary, but money now seems to be the lever to pull much more quickly than, any sort of conflict participation. And so now it feels like some of these issues put a strain on our economy, and the Fed is being asked almost to fight the war more so than the military is. And so I have this like theory in my head or a framework where I say Ukraine and Russia, sure, we probably have intelligence capabilities that are being deployed. We probably have some special forces that are being deployed. But really, that war is being fought in the Senate and Congress and at the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury more so than it is being fought by our armed services. And so that feels like it can accelerate the economic issues that we're facing as a country, because now it's like death by a thousand cuts. How do you view the integration or intersection of the economic problems with what seems to be geopolitical problems that now feels like it's, heads I lose, tails you lose type situation?
So that's a tough one. And that touches many, many issues, I think. I mean, high level, for one, why do we fight it at the money level? Because I don't think there's really that many people who want to go die for a battle over in Ukraine. I mean, in many ways, the triumph of the managerial regime means you have rule by technocrats, and technocrats ultimately like to push little levers on a spreadsheet, which is what you can do with money. There's a very big difference, but theoretically, you can push those same levers and send military over. But that relies on people who are willing to go risk their lives for that. And ultimately, managerial bureaucrats don't go risk their lives in a society that's been conditioned to this managerial ethos. You might get drone operators potentially. You're not going to get people who ultimately display the sort of virtues needed to, I think, truly fight an effective kinetic war. Nor when there's as much division at home and the sort of what we're fighting for is as abstract as this, are you going to find people, even those who would? I mean, the traditional kids of military families, very, very large numbers of them are not sending their kids into the military. You're seeing the situation where ultimately, I think it is an abstraction of government, and it's a move to what that results in is a result in truly a significant weakening of state capacity. Ultimately, a state that has something that people are willing to fight for has something perhaps intangible, but it can become very tangible, that's tremendously valuable, that a sort of administrative regime is just not going to have. And you've seen this in sort of late stage other empires, right? Roman Empire increasingly relied on mercenaries. Many empires increasingly relied on mercenaries, and you're just never going to get the same outcome from mercenaries. And I think in our society, you could argue that, I guess, paying for Ukrainians to go fight is sort of the equivalent of mercenaries at this stage. It's a financialization. From our perspective, it's a financialization and an outsourcing of the war needed to achieve the geopolitical goals of the current regime.
When Eric Prince started Blackwater years ago, I think that he maybe more so than most realized the world was changing, warfare was changing, the ability for the United States, both from a actual ability and a appetite to finance war, was changing. And he looks pretty prescient now, given kind of what he created. And it wasn't necessarily new. I think maybe it was just the modern version of what has existed literally for centuries, but even in recent decades. How do you view public versus private in warfare, and how much is the U.S. Going to be reliant on the private industry, both for weapons? We see Anduril obviously coming in, competing with a lot of the primes, but a lot of these kind of defense contractors in a world where we're not hitting recruiting goals of the military, it almost feels like they're going to become much, much more important in the coming years.
It's a good question, and it's one that I think I'd have a hard time saying exactly how that plays out. I mean, I look to some extent at sort of the disintegration of that public-private distinction. So going back to my point about sort of the tech companies being de facto governments, you certainly don't see a world where I think a lot of people are signing up for the U.S. in a way that matches sort of the public altruism associated with patriots fighting for their country. And that eliminates a large amount of the sort of public capability. So yes, you need to replace it with private. You need to replace it with outsourced sort of the Ukrainians are going and doing it for you. And yes, is that public? Is it private? I mean, from the perspective of sort of the U.S. regime, I'm not sure that it's meaningfully different, whether it be Blackwater or whether it be Ukrainians in certain ways. You're going to see I don't know about a sort of shift, but I think you'll see a confusion of those categories, a mixing of those categories. Now, what strikes me about Blackwater is there was the privatization. There was also the capability. Eric Prince ran an incredibly effective operation in a world where the military has become deeply bureaucratized. And this is sort of the opposite of what you would traditionally think of in public-private. Traditionally, mercenaries would be less effective. They would be sort of, they're there for the money, they're less motivated, they're probably less effective, but they're a supplement in certain cases. What you saw with Eric Prince, I think, was you saw he recognized the stagnation and bureaucratization of the military and the ability to actually get things done and operate at a higher level on the private side. And to the extent you see that, I think you're going to see a tremendous move in that direction, whether it be, and that could be something private like Blackwater. It could be, I think if Texas wanted to create a force to defend the border, equivalent to the Texas Rangers or something, you could see the best of the best join that. There would be a sense that they're fighting for something worth fighting for. There would be the ability to create standards. So that's public, obviously, that's at the state level, but it's something that is, it's something that's much closer to home in mission, and it's outside of the, it would be operating in that with a consciously different culture than the increasingly managerial, bureaucratized mainstream U.S. military. So either way, I think it's going to be, to some extent, it's a question of culture, and it's a question of sort of camaraderie, and do people have the ability, do they have the ability to do what ultimately men are looking to do if they're going to join a fighting force of some sort?
What is the thing you're most looking forward to over the next 5 or 10 years? Is it, could be political, it could be something that is technology, it could be personal, professional. When you look out, you know, everyone wants something to kind of aim for, try to achieve or look forward to. What is it for you?
To me, it's the paradigm shift that gets to that point I talked about in terms of the reorientation of the world around trust-based communities. So I think we're seeing the chaos and disintegration of a decline of the decline in trust in the institutions of the 20th century, legacy institutions largely of the 20th century, and really legacy models, very centralized models in the beginning of this century. And that certainly leaves people feeling like they're missing something. But in many ways, those lost partially because they already felt like they were already very impersonal. I expect that we see this tremendous sort of sea change, paradigm shift toward tribal alignment, you could say. People organizing around others, whether it's at the sort of community level or broader tribal level, that certainly is going to create a lot of chaos in the world. It's going to create major changes from certain of the comforts people are used to. But with it, it'll create, I would say, a tremendous rehumanization of society. Suddenly, people will be spending their day to day working with people who share their values and share their vision, instead of sort of so much of what we give to what feel like sort of nameless, faceless corporations, faceless bureaucracies, where there's no feeling of meaning. There's no feeling that you're actually building the country you want to build, the America you want to live in, build the town you want to live in. I think we'll see a move toward a world where most of what you get up and do is build a life with other people who want a similar way of life. Build relationships. The same relationships that might lead to opportunity are also just going to be relationships that lead to fraternity, to camaraderie with other people. And as that becomes a layer that can offer an alternative to what those institutions offer, those big corporate institutions, it's going to be something that more and more people gravitate toward. And to me, that's exciting. As I said, I think that's a multi-trillion-dollar opportunity. I also think it's something that people deeply crave in their bones. They crave the opportunity for being part of something like that, whether at a very small level or whether at a larger level with national impact. And I think that people are going to find homes in both of those. So that change is exciting. I mean, to sum it up, it is in a sense the sort of paradigm shift in trust-based interaction that is analogous to that move from sort of legacy monetary system and money creation to crypto. You'll see an analogous and I think larger move in how trust is mediated away from these centralized managerial institutions and toward more communal ones.
When people ask you, what is new founding? How do you describe it?
So new founding, high level, I say a venture firm. It's a venture firm for the American right. I define right in ways that go beyond conventional politics toward really three sets of trends. I also say venture firm. It's not explicitly venture capital. We do have a venture capital fund where we'll make investments, but we also build ventures, bring people together for ventures. So high level, fly a flag, be very public about certain sets of values, certain aspects of our perspective. People come to that. People are drawn to that. the flag that we fly, the values we state, are values that are, in a sense, it's a message that's scarce in society that not many people in our circles publicly broadcast, which means that when people hear it, they get to talk to us about things they might not be talking to anyone else about. We then are able to mediate connections between people, of which capital, venture capital connections may be one, but it may be people connecting in other ways to build institutions that can help realize that vision. So what are those values? How do I define the right? That's sort of the key question. And that is local, like family, household, local, even national self-determination. That to me is the solution to growing global disruption. Growing sort of bureaucratic stagnation and managerial dysfunction is one of the major problems. Solution to that is ownership and skin in the game. One of the key things we stand for, one of the things that anchors our vision is tools that can create greater ownership and skin in the game. Great cultural and political alienation. We just see widespread cultural and political alienation. We're focused particularly on a resurgence, sort of a re-emphasis on American ideals and Christian values. Again, not necessarily limited to a particular set of values, but a recognition that those are going to be core anchoring points for many communities. And I see those as deeply integrated. So the sort of ventures we build are going to be at the intersection. That's going to my last point, that I think decentralized, trust-based technologies will naturally find a home, naturally find early adoption in things like high-trust church communities, where traditionally you've had sort of technologists pursuing one of those at one angle, and often people who are somewhat techno-skeptical pursuing things in the other community. I believe those are coming together. So to sum it up, venture firm focused on the right, focused on kind of these general themes, and at the intersection of often very different circles, where I believe these macro trends are going to mean that solutions that bridge these worlds are going to be the winners in this space.
And where can we send people to find you online if they want to either read more of your writing, learn more about New Founding, or just follow along as you come up with more kind of content for them to consume?
So I'm very active on Twitter. Best place to follow me, go to Twitter, Nate A. Fisher. You can follow New Founding on Twitter as well. It lets you see sort of the venture firm. It lets you see the new real estate related project, a local community we're building that's gotten a lot of attention, and the other projects. You can go to our website, newfounding.com, learn about the venture fund there, learn about this Highland Rim project, this real estate project. And also we have a talent network. We have the opportunity to join our talent network, which ultimately is about connecting with other people around opportunities that build this world. So again, Twitter, Nate A. Fisher, New Founding, and newfounding.com.
I appreciate you coming on. I learn a lot every time we talk. I think that what you are working on is incredibly inspiring. Hope more people will follow your lead, and we'll definitely do this again in the future.
All right. Thank you for having me. It was great.